testing.
Is it going right? No, it hasn't. There it goes, now it goes, now it should be on. You want it?
Okay, today is 18, is it?
Yes.
18. Okay, today is
May 18th.
And we were talking last time, Dr. Scully, about the conversion. And
right.
We were going to start with that because I had a note about that. And I know we talked a little bit about that.
We were going to start with George's sabbatical that previous
right.
year because that's where it all came from. Well, anyway, 1975, there was clear evidence that medical schools were going to become difficult corporations to manage. And the AAMC, the Association of American Medical Colleges, was encouraging a lot of deans to go and get training in management. So George Smith and another, I don't know, 8 or 10 deans from around the country, I think were the first to go into a program at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, in the Sloan School of Business Management, or business, to take a year of management. Well, anyway, George had divorced his second wife and got married to Hancock Hillstrom. What was her first name? It'll come to me and I'll fill it in later. Susan Hancock Hillstrom. Anyway, of the Hancock Oil family, and she lived here in town, had married Dr. Earl Hillstrom, who was a surgeon in practice with Fred Anderson. Mm-hmm. Anyway, they got married, and off they went to Boston, and actually rented a house in Marblehead, which is north of Boston on the coast. I visited him once during that year. Anyway, they left, and he was in Boston from essentially July of 1975 to 1976, and I was appointed the acting dean, which was sort of a holding operation. It was an off year, one of the reasons he was permitted to go by President Miller, and then later Max Milam took over. He was permitted primarily because it was an off legislative year. And we were functioning pretty well. We were now in our fifth year as a two-year school, and things were going fairly well. Well, anyway, while he was there, it became clear that two-year schools were going to be a thing of the past. As a matter of fact, the federal government was in the process of passing, or had just passed, an amendment or an addition to the budget for HEW, which was Health, Education, and Welfare. Now it's called Health and Human Services, but then it was Health, Education, and Welfare. To encourage the two-year schools in the country, there were a handful, to convert to four-year schools, or get out of the business. And they essentially said that for the year you convert, every school would get, I think, $50,000 per student enrolled at the time in order to convert. Well, for our numbers, that amounted to a lump sum of about $2 million. But the more important thing was that we were having increasing difficulty after some 4 years of assuring our students that we could get them transferred. As I said earlier, Owen Peck did a very good job at this, but it was still essentially a hit or miss. Each year we had to go out and look for places. We didn't have any contracts per se assuring, 15 or 20 students going to a set place, although we were pretty fortunate to get a fair number of students accepted in Alabama and Southern Illinois University and a few others. At any rate, when George came back from his sabbatical, nothing dramatic happened in 1975. When he came back from his sabbatical, I recall very well he and I sitting and having a drink over at his house in earlier July, I think it was. He had rented an apartment with Susan over on by the Virginia Lake over there on Lakeside. He started telling me all this, and I wasn't as knowledgeable about what was going on nationally as George was. And George, having been at MIT and had gone to some dean's meetings, was fairly aware of what was going on politically and economically, said that we're going to have to convert, or we're probably not going to survive as a two-year school. So we called Fred Anderson. At that time, he was still on the Board of Regents, and we went and talked to him, and Fred, of course, was supportive. And we talked to Louis Lombardi, who was also on the Board of Regents. And then at that time, Ed Miller had already left. Jim Anderson had been the acting vice president for a while, and the Regents had appointed Max Milam. So we went to see Max Milam, as you remember, was had been a businessman, actually had been the, I think, the treasurer in the state government in Arkansas, and actually had been the head of the president or chief executive officer of the Rockefeller Foundation in Arkansas when, I guess it was Winthrop Rockefeller, was the governor of Arkansas. At any rate, Max was a real dollars and cents man. He knew money, he knew business. I got along with him very well. And so we went and talked to him. We laid out what we thought was the process we'd go through, laid out how we thought it would work, and he agreed. We then went to see Neil Humphrey. Neil was the chancellor at the time, and he agreed. So at this point, George then appointed, this was now in August, appointed a task force to put together a detailed proposal, which the regents would have to approve prior to the opening of the legislature. So this is August of 76. Our deadline was to get it to the regents by their December 76 meeting to put before the legislature in January of 1977. So I left the building up on the new campus, which at that time was the Anderson Building, and the Manville Building were built by then. And I went down and hid in a small room down in the old Mackey Science Building. Bud Baldwin and Paul Miller helped. George gave me a full-time secretary, and we essentially researched the whole thing, did some traveling, talked to a number of schools that were converting. Both Bud Baldwin and Paul Miller had a lot of experience in medical schools, and we sat down and essentially in a couple of months wrote the entire proposal, in which we would capture the several million dollars of conversion money. We would increase our class size, I think, to 48. We'd then have 4 years of students instead of two, which of course would increase tuition. We would go to foundations for money, a variety of things.
At that point, how many students were in the 2 years?
I think we had by then 44. We might have gone. Might have even been to 48. You know, frankly, I think by then we might have been at 48. I could look that up later. And we had George was then the politician. He had begun to talk to a number of the legislators as well as the regents in anticipation of this. And we started talking to Carol Logan, particularly at Washington Medical Center, and Ernie Mack. We anticipated, and of course we knew the VA would be okay, because the VA was supportive of medical education. And of course the VA wanted clinical programs in their hospital, because it helped them fostering recruitment of good physicians. So the VA and central office in Washington was supportive. So we figured we had enough clinical material at the VA in Reno and enough clinical material at Washoe. We subsequently found out that the degree of cooperation we had anticipated, some of that evaporated. And we also had some cooperation from Southern Nevada Memorial Hospital in Las Vegas, which it's UMC, but then it was the county hospital. So we outlined this entire thing, and we can excerpt in the final version of this some of the stuff from that article I wrote, as well as the conversion grant. I still have a copy in my closet there. And it outlines the whole thing, and we intended to have third and fourth year almost all in Reno. It subsequently turned out that we couldn't get obstetrics done here. The obstetricians were not very supportive, and there was a very small clinic OB population here. There was a much larger indigent population in Las Vegas, and in fact the obstetricians in Las Vegas were supportive of starting the 3 and 4 year school, and they had already had at UMC, well, in Southern Nevada, they already had a residency in OB that they had had originally with St. Mary's in San Francisco, and subsequently had an affiliation with Tulane. So, in fact, it turned out that that the OB, the obstetrics portion of the third year and the residencies would be done in Las Vegas. But initially, it was our intent to try to do the whole thing initially here in Reno and ultimately expand to Las Vegas. Remember, Las Vegas in 1976 was not the size it is now. And Northern Nevada was still, I think, had the larger population. At any rate, we outlined the whole thing. Oh, and we were going to have residencies, but we were only going to focus on primary care, because the whole issue in the country then was there were too many specialists, there was a disproportion, we needed more generalists. So, and of course, in 1969, family medicine had become a recognized specialty and had developed around the country an increasing number of three-year residency programs. So we said, okay, we will have a residency in family medicine, a residency in pediatrics, a residency in medicine, internal medicine, and a residency in OBGYN. We would not have surgery or any of the subspecialties. We'd just have four what we call primary care residencies. We defined OB as primary care for women. So medicine, OB, pediatrics, and family practice. Maybe in the future there might be surgery, there may be psychiatry, there might be other things, but the whole idea. So the actual proposal, as I recall, was the title of it was conversion to a four-year degree-granting medical school with residencies in primary care, the whole package. We also were one of the first schools to actually put in a third-year required clerkship in family medicine. Many schools had offered family medicine sort of as an elective, often in the senior year, but it wasn't a core clerkship in many medical schools. And we thought if we were going to be honest about this and talk about primary care, we had to expose the students to family medicine as well as have the family medicine residency.
You arrive at that just because of knowing what was going on.
What was going on nationally? Yeah, I think you're right, Eileen. It was going on nationally. The more and more push toward family medicine and primary care, and of course, we know the family physicians, the internists, and the pediatricians were fighting with each other about this. Mm-hmm. You know, what does it mean to be a family physician? You know, are you really an internist, or are you a baby doctor, or are you trying to do everything? And you know, the old adage about learning more and more about less and less until you know everything about nothing as a specialist, or the generalist who knows less and less about more and more until they know nothing about everything. And that's the old adage and the old saw, obviously a distortion. But it was true that family medicine was going to try to do some OB, but not surgery. Some general internal medicine, but not the subspecialties. Some pediatrics, but not newborn care.
Did you have a lot of support locally?
A fair amount of it.
Family practitioners?
Yeah,
no objection.
They were supportive. There was objection, but the objections came, I think, although it wasn't articulated this way, I think it came that, as we were talking last time, about a competition. You know, if you start residencies in family medicine, you're going to train and educate my competition.
Right.
Same with pediatrics, same with OB. And, you know, it's okay if you do it in Las Vegas, just don't do it in my backyard or vice versa. So there was, but there, most of the leadership of family medicine in those days were supportive, at least publicly. And I think they had to be supported because they were beating the drum for family medicine residency nationally and supporting nationally. It didn't make an awful lot of sense for the leadership of family medicine in Nevada to beat the drum nationally, but then not support it in their own state. So there was, I'm sure, ambivalence, and ambivalence is the word.
Yeah.
At any rate, that was the proposal. We got it done. I worked day and night. I never worked harder in my life. And I essentially wrote it all, but I have to admit, we got a lot of help. Merle Haber had come by that time, and chairman of
that filled out
pathology.
Your chairmanships, didn't it?
Yeah, for the basic sciences. Mm-hmm. Merle helped. Matt Bach had a lot of 25 years in medical schools. He was very helpful. Paul Miller, a psychiatrist, and Bud Baldwin, a pediatrician, they were all helpful. And they fed me a lot of information, and It actually, I must say, I was one of the things in my career that I think I'm proudest of is being the author of that proposal and bringing all those people together and writing what many have said was a very well done, coherent, logical, and supportable. I mean, we had all the facts and data. We had statistics on the number of doctors in Nevada and how many would be needed over the next 25 years. Because it was always the concern, well, you're going to glut the market. Well, we haven't glutted the market, obviously. But we had put all those statistics in there. The justification for converting, survival of the school, continuing to provide educational opportunities for Nevadans who wouldn't have to go out of state, begin to provide residencies in state, although OB was already here, and our own kids, our own people would then be able to come to medical school, well, go to college, but come to medical school, get 4 years here, get a degree in Nevada, and then get, at least in primary care, roughly half of them or so, we predicted would go into primary care, and hopefully many of them would stay, and we'd begin to have an impact on health care. So I think it was a well done proposal, and we put it before the regents at the December meeting, and it in December of 76, and it passed. And then the chancellor and the president, who at that time was Max Milam, and the chancellor Neil Humphrey, were authorized to take it to the legislature. They put together a bill. Then when it came, and the bill was introduced, I can't remember who actually introduced it, but we had gone to see, George and I and the Chancellor and the President had gone to see Mike O'Callaghan. Of course, everything had to be approved by the Governor in those days, and if it wasn't in the Governor's budget, forget it, it would never get anywhere. So we went to see Mike, and he was very supportive during the Christmas holidays. He was supportive. I made a little presentation to him. Since I had written the proposal and made up a whole bunch of slides and had a show and tell, I was probably more knowledgeable than anybody, although George was certainly the front man who had to do the politics.
What was he doing during this time?
Well, George was still running the school. I mean, he was back
and
running.
You were doing all this other?
Well, I was totally out of this. I taught maybe one or two classes, but I was essentially for three and a half, four months doing that. So George was back in the dean's office doing all the other stuff that needed to be done. So Mike O'Callaghan then, the key was he put it in his State of the Union address, or the whatever they call that speech he gives to the legislature on opening day in late January, came out very, very supportive, had it in his budget. George and the other, and the chancellor and others had gotten to the key legislators. Although Floyd Lamb, who was head of the Senate Finance Committee, and Jim Gibson were not very supportive, they thought, I think they really felt down deep that if it was going to expand, it ought to go to Las Vegas, which it ultimately eventually has.
They were both Las Vegas.
Yeah, sure, sure. And that it was going to be too expensive. And there were a fair amount of opposition, most of it from the Las Vegas legislators, senators and assemblymen, all of saying, you know, it was going to break the state and it was going to be too expensive. Well, we had done a lot of work on the multiplier effect. That is, there have been a lot of studies around the country about if you spend a dollar in education at various levels, it will multiply in terms of your economy and in developing professionals, etc. And that clearly the medical school would bring in more money than the state ever expended on it. And in fact, that's turned out to be the case. Sure. I think the budget of the medical school in the last few years has been in the $50 to $60 million range, and the state puts in $5 or $6 million. So for every dollar the state puts in, the medical school faculty brings in from foundations and federal grants and patient dollars, because now their faculty are seeing patients and generating dollars, have brought in six, seven, eight dollars for every dollar expended. So what we had predicted has come to pass, but at the time, it was very suspect. You know, this is smoke and mirrors. You're promising something you can't deliver. It's going to cost too darn much money. But the governor, Mike O'Callaghan, was very supportive, and enough key senators and assemblymen were. And so then, during the legislature, it fell to me. George and I would always go together. George would make some introductory remarks, and it fell to me then to actually make the presentations because I knew all the facts and figures. So I made the presentation several to the Assembly Committees, Ways and Means, and the Senate Finance. And at that time, Don Mello was very supportive, and he was the head of the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee. And he was wise politically, I guess. He said, for us to pass it as a committee and then try to sell the rest of the legislature might not be as effective as if you spoke to the entire legislature. So he did an unusual thing, I'm now told. He called a committee of the whole, where the entire legislature went into the chambers, and after some introductory remarks by George, I got up, and I'd had no slides then, but we had handouts. We carefully, Edna Brigham helped me a lot on this, and she was working in George's office at the time, and Bud Walden. We put together some critical handouts, and Phil Gillette had done a lot of work with me on putting the budget together, because both Floyd Lamb on the Senate side and Don Mello on the Assembly side wanted to see 4, 6, 8 year projections. It's one thing to say tomorrow it's going to cost you a dollar. What's going to cost us in 8 to 10 years? So we had to sit down and try to project on the, and I've got all those figures. We had big, long spreadsheets that Phil would type up or put on his computer in those days.
He was the money man.
Yeah, Phil was the business manager at the time, and he had a very good assistant by the name of Rogers. His first name will come to me in a minute, who left later. And then he was replaced by Leah Gorbett. But at this time, it was Bud Rogers and Phil Gillette, that's who it was. And they did the dollars and cents, and we actually went through and projected, if we converted as we planned to in 1978, what it would cost through about 1984, I think 6 years. And we tried to, you know, a reasonable 8 to 10% inflation rate, and where the money was going to come from. Because everybody knew that eventually the conversion money would run out, and the Hughes money would run out, and then there'd have to be some sources of dollars.
The conversion money, now, that was going to be per
one lump sum.
A lump sum, one time.
One time. And you used it any way you want. So we took that I'd have to go back and look up the figures. We took those $2 million and spread them out over, I don't know, 4 years or so, five, so I'm not sure exactly. I have to go back and look those figures up.
May I interrupt here?
Sure.
Hold on to where we are in the conversion
process. Yeah, sure.
Because I have a couple of questions about the buildings. When did that occur? The Anderson Building, the Manville Building.
Right.
Were you acting dean then?
I was the acting dean during, as a matter of fact, I sent out a letter to every physician in the state when we wanted to put up the Savitt Building. We need a library, and said that we'd put their name on a plaque if they gave $1,000. And that plaque that sits in the hall as you go in there has 200 names on it, many of them my friends, the doctors, who sent $1,000 or more, and that generated about $200,000.
But the first building was the
Anderson Building. Well, we, as you know, the first building was really the Mackey Science and
but that was on lower campus.
Down lower campus. And the first building was the Anderson Building.
Right. But the first building on the upper campus.
Was it Anderson, and it opened in 1972.
Okay.
And that was called Phase 1, the Fred Anderson Building. We actually opened it in 1972.
Okay.
Then the Manville Building, the Ed Manville Building, we got the money for that in 75 and started building it actually while George was on his sabbatical. Mm. And when he arrived home in August of 76, we opened that building.
We didn't have any experience with the building program.
Who?
You. This was your first one.
I learned.
Yeah.
I learned.
You sort of learned everything by this.
I learned a lot by this. And no, but I also had good mentors, and I had very good support, and I had good friends who, you know, but a lot of it I was just learning. And I would think that that looking back, part of why I guess I was appointed the dean was that I did have the ability to get people to work together.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, if you can get people to work together, you don't have to have all the answers yourself. You got other people with the answers.
This was a big strength. What did you think about that year when you were acting dean?
I think
you had so many calls in the fire at this point.
Right.
I mean, irons in the fire. What did you think about a future in this kind of thing?
I then decided that I was going to stay in academic medicine. Mm-hmm. Now, at the time, I didn't know George was going to resign, and I didn't know I'd be appointed dean in a couple of years. Mm-hmm. But I decided I was going to stay on the academic administrative side. I had even thought of going away for a sabbatical and doing some business like George had. But when George came back, the decision was made by lots of people, let's convert the school. And so then I jumped in, and George says, you know, you're the one to do it. You put it together. Then, of course, having put it together, it was my job to then sell it to people, essentially. And once I sold it, and George then the next year decided to leave, they said,
it comes together
in just a minute. Okay. But we were working at that time, we were working on the Phase 3 building, which was ultimately known as the Ellis Abbott building, and that's where I sent out the letter and got $200,000. And it actually turned out to be $140,000, it says here. But if you look in this page 322 of this article I wrote, which we'll put in the book eventually, you'll see that in there, there was virtually no university money, virtually none. Well, there was of the entire $3.6 million for those three buildings, the university put in $80,000 of capital. Out of $3,646,000, all the rest, as you see by that chart, came from grants from HEW, $2.3 million, Kellogg, Fleischmann, the Summa Corporation, which was used, and our own fundraising. That letter I sent, that was another $870,000.
So that indicated great community support, too. All the physicians at this point are jumping on the bandwagon.
Well, at least, yeah, and they...
Many of them.
So that was going on. Well, anyway, we're in the legislature, and the governor's supportive. And what they did is we had Don Mello called a committee of the whole, and all of them were sitting there, and... as I said, after George's introduction, I get up and I presented the whole thing. They gave me about 40 minutes, I think, and we had handouts, but we told them the reason we wanted to do it, what the alternatives were, primarily shut the school down, and some people were in favor of that, I'm sure, how much it was going to cost. We then projected, almost 8 years of what it would probably cost the state, where the money would come from, how we'd use the conversion money, how we generate dollars by seeing patients, etc. And finally, it passed, and it was on April the 14th of 1977 that it passed. The Assembly voted 35-5 in favor, and the Senate voted 15-5 in favor. The five no's in the Assembly and the five no's in the Senate, all 10 of them were from Las Vegas. I can't tell you the exact names of who at the time.
Mm-hmm.
I think they were all. I'm almost sure everybody in the North, and a number of the Southerners, as well as the people from the rural area, were in favor. Well, that was in marked contrast to starting the 2-year school in 1969. So that was 8 years earlier, mm-hmm. when it passed by one vote. So by then we had had enough.
We had
a track record. Our students were being transferred. Several were actually coming back to Nevada to practice. So we no longer were just betting on the come, as they say in gambling. We weren't saying this is what we think is going to happen. We actually had 5 years experience. They saw that we could do what we said we could do. We had gotten the 2-year kids through, and now they were graduating. We had actually bodies with MD degrees attached. And we had gone out and raised, as we said earlier, almost all the money for the buildings, 85-90% of the money for the buildings we raised. They didn't build the buildings. And we raised a lot of the money for, but of course even the legislature always took credit for the Hughes money and assigned it to the appropriated funds. They always stuck that in there, which used to gall George and me, because they would hand it a gift. But anyway, that's politics.
Now the Hughes money was still coming in at this
point. Yeah, there was, I think it was a 20-year gift. It originally came. It was originally going to be $6 million over 20 years. They renegotiated later, around this time, or maybe a little later. They renegotiated to $4 million over 20 years. They cut it down, mm-hmm. And so, lo and behold, they approved it. And I can remember George had, we hadn't started building the Savitt building. So at that time, if you can imagine, we had the Anderson building. And then down below on the side of the hill, we had the Manville building with an auditorium. And we used to walk down the stairs, or slide down the hill in the wintertime. We'd walk down the stairs to go from one building to the next, and it made logical sense to put the Savitt building right in between, with the dean's office on the ground floor and the library on the second floor, and that's ultimately what happened. But at the time, there were two separate buildings with a big wind tunnel down the middle in that, what is now that little quadrangle. It wasn't attached at the front, it wasn't attached at the back, although that was the intent. Two separate buildings. We had the freshmen now in the Anderson building, and we had the sophomores in the Manville building in the auditorium. George had an office where Jerry May now sits, and I had the office right next to it where Dagmar now sits. And it was a big opening, with room dividers where we had secretaries and Phil Gillette and Edna Brigham and others. And I can remember we all gathered into George's office the day they voted in April and opened up a bottle of champagne.